Well, we have finished a first round of our English 245 biblical literature class by looking through the Bible, picking out certain key passages, certain well-known stories, some of the best poetry, and just trying to get a feel for the culture, trying to get a feel for the history, the main characters, some of the major themes that we encounter in the Bible. But of course, so far we really haven't focused on the literature aspect of it. Yes, we've looked at the Bible and we've read through it, but we haven't looked at specifically the literature itself. We need to do that. So in this next section, we're going to look at the Bible again, but now that we have a basis for understanding the characters and some of the actions, now we can look at it from the different kinds of literary forms that are in the Bible. We think about the Bible, we say it as if it's one thing. And yes, it's one collection, but inside the Bible there are stories, we have poetry, letters. We just talked about one of Paul's letters, Romans. There are parables, interesting stories that Jesus told. We have proverbs, wise sayings. We've got gospels that are a particular kind of literature. There's satire. There's something called apocalyptic writing. That would include the book of Revelation, but there's some other books that have at least sections, if not entire books devoted to apocalyptic literature. And that's actually a particular kind of writing as well. And it's like any other ball game that you watch, any other sport. I've been watching some rugby, and I like rugby, but I don't understand half the rules. And so if I knew those rules, I would enjoy it more. And the same is true when it comes to literature. You can get more out of the Bible if you understand the rules and to see what people are doing within the rules and how they make the rules work for the story itself or for the poem. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at the different kinds of literary forms from here on out. So, for example, we'll spend probably most of the time, well, at least a good chunk of the time, talking about stories in the Bible, because that's the predominant form of literature that we see there. And then we'll look at poetry. That's another big section of the Bible. And then some smaller areas would be proverbs and gospels and parables, epistles, satire, and visionary literature or apocalyptic literature. So that's what we want to go to for the rest of the time for these MP3s. So the first thing we want to do as an introduction is just to talk about the value of literature itself. Why do we spend so much time? Why do people enjoy literature so much? Well, I thought maybe as a start we could look at the story of the Good Samaritan, a story that Jesus told in Luke 10. And let me just read it. It's short enough. Here's 30. Jesus says, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. When he fell into the hands of robbers, they stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. 'Look after him,' he said, 'and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expenses you may have.'" So there's the story. Now, of course, the setting is important, isn't it, for every story. What was going on here was a guy who comes up to Jesus, they said was trying to test him. And so he says to Jesus, "So what do I have to do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus turns right around and puts a question on this guy. What does it say to do in the books of Moses? He says, "Well, you got to love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus says, "Well, that's it. There you go." And the man says, "But who's my neighbor?" Now that's a question, isn't it? It's a key question. Just because it says love your neighbor, what does that mean? And of course, for a Jew, at this time period, a person is thinking, now let's see, it probably would include people that live on either side of me and maybe the person across the street. Not so sure about the guy down the block. And somebody from a different city, nah, forget it. But he's got that question, what does it mean to be a neighbor? Well, if he had come to us and said, "So what does that mean, a neighbor?" We'd probably say, "A neighbor by definition is somebody you live near." Well, okay, that's true, that's a definition. But notice it doesn't have the power that the story had that Jesus told. But why is that? Why did the story have more power than a dictionary definition? Because the story brings this abstraction, this conceptual idea of what it means to be a neighbor, it brings that into action. It brings it alive. It drapes flesh over it. And so we don't get that abstraction. Experiences always are more powerful for us than abstractions. People today like stories. Tell us stories. And so experiences are what are powerful. And the Bible is just full of experiences. And they illustrated concepts that all of us share. Things like fear and faith and doubt and hatred and love and courage. Now you think about stories in the Old Testament. Instead of just saying it's important that you be a person of faith, what do we get? We get stories of faith of Moses. We get stories about the faith of Abraham and others. We get a story of hatred that's in the story of Haman in the book of Esther. We'll get to that pretty soon. Well, okay, but how is a story more effective? Yes, it grabs us, but what does it do? It gets us emotionally, doesn't it? It gets us right in the pit of our stomachs. You look at that story that Jesus told about the Good Samaritan. Why was that one powerful? It wasn't just a story. It was a powerful story because here's a guy who's a nice person. And he just happens to be in a bad area and he falls in the hands of robbers. He wasn't doing anything. So here's a totally innocent individual. And they take everything. They strip him of his clothes. How embarrassing, right? Especially for a society back then to be stripped naked. And they beat him, and then they leave him half dead. Absolute cruel people. And then individuals come down the street, and each time the Jewish person hearing the story is thinking, oh good, a priest, that'll be good. Oh good, a Levite. But these people don't help. And so that's exciting, but that's sad because we're thinking, well, those are the people that are good in our society. Why didn't they help him? And then Jesus hits him with the most powerful example of all after the priest and the Levite. A Samaritan comes by. You talk about a kick to the stomach. The Jews did not want to hear about a good Samaritan. Samaritans were half-breeds to them. They were the lowest of the low. It'd be like today, we might say, and a member of Al-Qaeda came by, or a member of some terrible gang, or some awful drug dealer, or something like that, somebody that we didn't like at all. So this is a story that grabs us emotionally, and it makes us use our imagination and create strong feelings within us. So a story is sensual. It brings it to life so we can see it. That's what I mean by sensual. It relates to our senses. We can imagine being on the road with this man getting beat up. There's a form there, kind of like a game that you play that has boundaries and lines and rules, and so does a good story. There's an emotional connection that goes on there. There's a use of your imagination. I've asked readers several places in these MP3s to think about using your imagination. What would that be like to be in that particular time? Well, okay, so that's how a story can do it. I would say a poem is the same way. I asked people to take a look at the 23rd Psalm. We didn't talk about it when we went through here before. Well, let's just read it now real quickly. It's not very long. 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Well, again, did you notice? We talk about the rules, the lines that are drawn for games. This is in, this is out, this is a good shot, this is a bad shot, this is a three-point basket, this is a two-point basket. Well, we get lines, in a sense, drawn in a different way, don't we, in a poem. Do you notice it's laid out? The actual lines of the print are laid out differently than what we've seen in stories. So there's something going on there. You're forced to slow down. because of these lines. You can't just whip across the page here. So each word is going to stand out more clearly. And so look at the words that stand out. Things like, the Lord is my shepherd. He does these things for me. He leads me. He restores. He guides. These are some of the opening parts of these lines. And you have to pay more attention to the words, don't you? And again, do you recognize that this is not an abstraction? This is not a generalization like, God is good to me. God is a guide. God is a help to me. No, God is a shepherd. That's sensual. That gives you a form. You can picture shepherds, especially in this society, how important a shepherd was. Of course, if it's a shepherd, then you've got sheep. And so who are the sheep? I guess the people are. So God's that far above us as a shepherd is over the sheep. So God's not just a leader, right? He's a shepherd. He's a real example of a leader here. Did you notice something else? It says, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Now that may be real death, but it could be a figure of speech, couldn't it? And if God is my shepherd, that makes me a sheep. That's a figure of speech. I must be some kind of sheep. Okay. Well, that's powerful when we can visualize and use figures of speech, when we can emotionally connect, when we have a sensual form for this piece of literature. And so as we go through reading, please read carefully. This is not beach reading, right? Slow down a little bit. Put yourself in there. Try to visualize. Try to match these things with your experiences that you know of life. Have you experienced things like these? Have you felt fear? Have you felt jealousy? Have you felt anger? Well, so have these characters. Know some of the rules. We'll be talking about that as we go through it. So I hope that's helpful to you as far as just a general introduction here. Now, at this point, let's take a look at stories in the Bible. I asked my students to read the book of Esther, which we didn't go over when we read through the Bible before. But looking at the book of Esther, we'll come across different things as we explore literature. So today we're going to talk about setting. Right, there are a lot of things that make up a good story. So we're looking at stories in the Bible. So for the next couple of MP3s here, I'd like to just focus on stories, because there's so much going on in a good story, and the Bible is full of them. So we'll look at the first thing, a setting. You can't have a story unless you have a place for it to happen. But a lot of people say, well, sure, you got to put a story somewhere. Just plop it down, whether it's New York City or at the beach or on the moon if you're a science fiction writer. But keep in mind, setting can do so much more, and setting involves so much more than just a physical place. Sometimes the setting includes the moral background, the culture of the area, the history of it. You know, for example, I read a science fiction story, but it was involving time travel back to medieval Europe. It's called The Doomsday Book. You might enjoy it. And they're in the time of the bubonic plague. Now, you need to know, what was the culture like then? What was the history like? What were the feelings that predominated this time? Probably a lot of despair. And so we're not used to that, because we have our medicines and we feel pretty good most of the time. But that's not just a place to set the story. Did you notice there's all this other undercurrent of the setting that's important? Now, let's think back to the Bible stories that we've read. How many times was the setting important? For example, you had to know some of the beliefs, you had to know some of the customs. Well, think about the times where, let's take the Jacob and Esau story with Isaac. Esau doesn't really care about his birthright, and Jacob makes a big deal about it and steals it from him. Here we are in the 21st century. This stuff about birthrights doesn't make any sense to us. We don't live in that kind of environment. And so the setting is more than just desert people and shepherds and and livestock and things like that, but it's a culture, it's a way of doing things, and that's why it's really important, if you can, to get yourself a study Bible that has notes in case you don't know the background and what's going on here. A lot of cultural differences as we read through the Bible. So that's hugely important. So we do need to think about the background and the setting. Okay, let's go on now. Setting does some things for us, doesn't it? It obviously lets us know the locale. But it does more than that. Let me read to you. I asked people to read the book of Esther. Let me just read to you part of the story. This is chapter 1 in Esther. It says that the king, Xerxes, gave a banquet for nobles and officials. Some people believe that this banquet was the time when Xerxes was plotting his invasion of Greece. And so if you've ever read or heard about some of the famous battles, Thermopylae or Salamis or Marathon or whatever, the Persians attempted to invade Greece. And some people think, since this is the king of Persia, excuse me, this may be that particular time period. Before we get the story of what Xerxes does, we get setting. And this, I told you, most of the time the Bible doesn't really give us a lot of detail. It tends to be underwritten, but listen to these details here. Verse 4 of chapter 1 in the book of Esther. For 180 days he displayed the wealth of his kingdom, the splendor and glory of his majesty. He gave a banquet, it says, in the enclosed garden of the king's palace. And then look at this description. The garden had, verse 6, the garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, so you didn't have to sit around and wait for the king to watch what he did. He just said, go, you know, have a good time. It says the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Well, what I would like you to take away from there is the focus on setting. Now, it did tell us the locale, didn't it? It did say it was in the land of Persia, and we got Xerxes, and this is in his palace. But would you agree that it does more than this? That it begins to give us a feeling for what's coming? There's symbolism here in the way the king has piled up all this stuff. All these things symbolize the power of his kingdom. And so later on in the story, when Esther is willing to clash with the king, willing to take him on, when he sets up a decree that says the Jews are going to be wiped out, this is the full power behind this man. It's a tremendous kingdom. It's huge. It's got wealth beyond belief. And we get all of that from this opening. So when it looks like the king is going to turn against the Jews, we get extremely nervous because we've seen the power that he has here. So that's amazing. We're already ready to understand the characters better. We've got the physical setting. There's a mood that's established. I would say some symbolism as well. So those are the kinds of things that a story can do for us. It's way more than just a physical place, right? Setting can create a tremendous antagonism, a nervousness, a feeling of calm. It's easier for me just to give you some examples here. So you see it in the book of Esther. Let me give you a couple of examples from American literature so that you get that feeling for the power of a setting, and that when you're reading, you don't just skip over this and get to the, let's move along, let's get to the story. No, you want to slow down, you want to think about the setting here. Here's the opener for a very famous American novel. A throng of bearded men in sad colored garments and gray steeple crowned hats, intermixed with women, some wearing hoods and others bareheaded, was assembled in front of a wooden edifice, the door of which was heavily timbered with oak and studded with iron spikes. Okay, now you may recognize this, and I'll just go ahead and tell you, but this was from Scarlet Letter by Hawthorne. But notice we don't have any action yet. It just says there's a bunch of people standing there. But can you begin to feel, just from the setting, what's coming up in the story? It says people in sad-colored garments. Okay, so this is not a pretty, uplifting scene. This is pretty grim. And it says they're in front of a wooden edifice. Okay, fine. But the door is heavily timbered with oak. Okay, so it's thick. It's rough. It's tough. It's oppressive in a way, and it's studded with iron spikes. So it expects trouble, and it's there to defend, to endure. This is hardness. Now, when Hester Prynne comes into this story, and the people of the town turn against her, can you see what she's up against? Can you already feel in your gut what it's going to be like? This is not a group of people that are going to say, oh, you know, sorry you had some problems, you got pregnant, that's okay, let's just love and forgive and move on. This is not the kind of society that's going to do that. We know that already, just from the setting. Pretty powerful. If you have a chance, I'm not going to read it now because it would take too long, but look at the opening of Grapes of Wrath by Steinbeck. It takes a look at the land. There's not even a person in the story yet. And it looks at the land about how the rains came and then they don't come anymore. And the corn tries to grow, but it gets drier and drier, and the surface of the ground gets crustier, and the colors leach out of the ground. And it's so sad. You just feel the dryness and the aridity of the area. Let me give you a short one again. First lines from The Bridges of Tokori, which is a story of the Korean War from the viewpoint of pilots in the air, part of the air war. It says, the sea was bitter cold. From the vast empty plains of Siberia, howling winds roared down to lash the mountains of Korea, where American soldiers lost on patrol, froze into stiff and awkward forms. Then with furious intensity, the Arctic wind swept out to sea, freezing even the salt spray that leaped into the air from crests of falling waves. Now, could you feel the sweep of the story here? It starts in Siberia, winds come pouring down into Korea, and then out to sea, to the ocean. And what's going to happen, of course, these are aircraft carriers off the coast of Korea flying missions. And then, so in a sense, it's like a camera panning from Siberia down through Korea and out to the ocean. So it does an interesting job of just moving the story into where we're going to focus. But more than that, can you feel the coldness? These are soldiers. Just nature is against them. This is a harsh, harsh world. There's no warmth to this at all. And as we read the story, we're prepared to encounter a very tough story because of the setting that's given to us. Now, again, it's a long section. I guess I won't read it to you, but if you take a look at a book called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, it was a look at people coming over, immigrants coming to the Chicago area and trying to make a life for themselves, and they're excited because they're in the new world and they expect good things to happen. But when we read the kind of setting, the kind of place that they're coming to, we say, uh-oh, this is not good at all. For example, they come over to an area, they're looking for a home to stay in, and they come to something called Made Ground, M-A-D-E, Made Ground. In other words, it's been created. And it says, here was a great host, perhaps two city blocks square, with long files of garbage wagons creeping into it. The place had an odor for which there are no polite words, and it was sprinkled over with children who raked in it from dawn till dark. Sometimes visitors from the packing houses would wander out to see this dump, and they would stand by and debate as to whether the children were eating the food they got or merely collecting it for the chickens at home. And then, how about this? They come across a big hole as they're walking. It says, which was empty, not yet filled up. Says this held water, and all summer it stood there with the nearby soil draining into it, festering and stewing in the sun. And then when winter came, somebody cut the ice on it and sold it to the people of the city. Wow. So they're selling this filthy, filthy water. And so these two people come in, they're all excited. This is their land, this is their new setting. And you read this and you think, oh, this is going to be tough for these people. And it is. The whole story is the difficulties that they encounter. Probably the author who's known for doing an exceptional job with setting is Edgar Allan Poe. Here are the opening words from his famous story, The Fall of the House of Usher. Again, you know by now what I'd like you to do. Think, react. What does your gut tell you as you hear him describe this opening scene? How is setting doing more than just Poe saying, oh, I think I'll just put this story here where this house is? This is going to do far more. Yes, it's got a physical setting, but we are getting prepared to meet the people inside the house of Usher. I think we're prepared for a certain set of characters just because of the setting. I think a certain mood is being established, and there's certainly a symbolism here. And again, I won't take the time to explore all of those, but just see if that comes through to you as I read this to you. During the whole of a dull, dark, and soundless day in the autumn of the year, when the clouds hung oppressively low in the heavens, I'd been passing alone on horseback through a singularly dreary tract of country, and at length found myself, as the shades of the evening drew on, within view of the melancholy house of Usher. I know not how it was, but with the first glimpse of the building, a sense of insufferable gloom pervaded my spirit. I looked upon the scene before me, upon the mere house and the simple landscape features of the domain, upon the bleak walls, upon the vacant eye-like windows, upon a few rank sedges, and upon a few white trunks of decayed trees, with an utter depression of soul. I reined my horse to the precipitous brink of a black and lurid tarn that lay in unruffled luster by the dwelling, and gazed down, but with a shudder even more thrilling than before, upon the remodeled and inverted images of the gray sedge and the ghastly tree stems and the vacant and eye-like windows. Well, isn't that cheery? But again, do you hear that? Let me just pick certain words out of there and notice the impact, the emotional impact. It was a dull, dark, and soundless day. There aren't any birds. It's just soundless. This is almost science fiction, isn't it? And of course, it's in autumn. Why autumn? Well, it's not, everything's not totally dead, but it's heading toward death. But when he encounters the characters in the house, he's going to find the same true there. The clouds are not fluffy high clouds. They're hanging oppressively low. And of course, he's alone. So when he comes into this house, there's nobody else to back him up and help him. It's, of course, as the shades of evening drew on. It's not black yet, but shades of evening are drawing on. So if you've ever been out as the sun has gone down, you start losing the color of the world. And this is what's going to happen inside the house. The life is draining out of the characters inside the house. And so he looks at everything is decaying. And he's going to find decay in the house as well. Now that's obviously a very blatant example of it, but that's what I want you to think about. As you're looking through these stories, think about the settings, the crucial role of a setting. Allow yourself to slow down and enjoy that and to read it imaginatively. And think about the physical setting that's there, sure. But think about what you can anticipate as far as the characters in this. Think about the mood that's established. It was a dark and stormy night. Think about symbolic meanings, things that are set up immediately through the use of setting. Well, let me connect it to the Bible for a few minutes, and then we'll stop at this point, and we'll pick up some other things that a story has to do, other jobs a story needs. Let's take those jobs of the setting we talked about before. We need the physical part. Well, we get it in Esther, don't we? I just read you that part, the physical part. I would suggest stories like the story of the Pharaoh when the Exodus is taking place. Think about that. We're set inside the court of the Pharaoh, the most powerful man of this time. We're prepared for a haughty, prideful kind of individual, and we do. We meet him in the Pharaoh. Think about Daniel as he's inside a land that is hostile to Jews. We're prepared for some tough times there. What about mood in the story? We're in the Garden of Gethsemane, outside the city. There's no bustle. There are probably no lights. And this is the time when Jesus is at his lowest and is about to be taken by the mob that's come out there. Think about symbolism as far as stories go with the setting. We have the Tower of Babel. Yes, there's a physical structure there, but it's far more than that, isn't it? It's a symbol of reaching to God through your own efforts. And, of course, it comes to naught as a result. Symbolism of mountains, very powerful symbols in the Bible of trying to get close to God. Mount Carmel is a good example where Elijah takes on the prophets of Baal. So as you read the Bible, and as you read any kind of literature, slow down, enjoy the settings, and realize that the authors are trying to do something valuable with them as well, as just setting the story someplace. Okay, so next time we'll take a look at the characters of a story.